For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We're in this really sweet section of the Gospel of Luke, moving towards the end of what has sometimes been referred to as the era of popularity in Jesus' teaching, mostly around Galilee, where he is teaching in increasingly clear terms about who he is, and that he is demonstrating who he is as Messiah through various supernatural actions that show that he has the authority of God. And we talked about that in chapter 7 over the last couple of weeks, his authority over death itself and raising this widow's son from the dead, healing the Roman centurion's servant, and then in his ability to forgive this so-called sinful woman who broke in on the dinner party. We're going to talk a little bit more tonight about the things that Jesus does because they underscore who he is and another dimension of his authority. This from chapter 8, verses 26 to 39. Jesus encounters a demoniac. So there's some things to think about here. Let's take a look at the text and then we're going to think it through together. It says that Jesus and his disciples sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposed to Galilee, which is on the other side of the Sea of Galilee from where he was. And when he came out onto the land, he was met there by a man from the city who had been possessed with demons, and he had not been clothed for a long time, quite a sight to see, and was not living in a house but among the tombs. Seeing Jesus, he cried out and he fell before him, saying, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" Interesting, in Luke, you see it in chapter 5 as well, in an interaction with the demoniac. Their theology is pretty good. He says, I beg you, do not torment me. And then it says that, for Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. He had been fit with seizures many times, was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard, and yet he would break his bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. And so Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion, for many demons had entered him." Legion is a Latin word, actually. It's a Roman military term, and it relates to a member of a legion would be anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000 people. So to be named Legion, this guy's really in over his head. They were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss. But there was a herd of swine feeding there in the mountain, and the demons implored him to permit them to enter the swine. So Jesus gave them the permission, and the demons came out of the man and entered the swine. The herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. And when the herdsmen saw what happened, they ran away and reported it to the city and about the country. And the people went out to see what happened. And they came to Jesus and they found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting down at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And they became frightened. Those who saw this reported how the man was demon-possessed and had been made well. And all the people of the country of the Gerasenes and the surrounding district asked him to leave them, for they were gripped with fear. And Jesus got into a boat and returned to the other side of the lake. Okay, there you have the story of the Gerasene demoniac. There's a parallel account of that also in the Gospel of Mark chapter 2. And I have been thinking about this all week, and I'm just going to, it's time for confession time, okay? I got three questions about this passage that every time I read it, and I've been reading it now off and on for 40 years, so it's not new to me, but there are questions that just come to my mind every time I read this passage. I suspect they're the same kinds of questions that are in your mind as well, and these I want to investigate together with you tonight. Three questions are these. One, why does this give you that uncomfortable, embarrassed feel? Now, come on. I know. You read something like this and you're like, you know, this is so far removed from the world that we live in. And it makes us think, well, you know, is this just some kind of a primitive record of suspicious people who just don't understand science and what's wrong with people and stuff, so they attribute to the demonic? That would be the kind of the common thread in our culture. I want to investigate that question just a bit more fully here with you. A second question I've got is, if this is the way it really is, if there is this, you know, spiritual battle waging in the unseen world as the Bible describes, and there's God and there's God's adversary, who is this person called Satan, and he has his own force, just like God has an angelic host. You know, why don't we see this kind of stuff today? I bet if I asked you how many people have seen a demoniac naked running through the tombs near your house, my guess is that very few of you would be willing to raise your hand. And so I want to talk a little bit about that too. Why don't we see this thing today? Because it makes us feel just even further removed, I think, from this passage, that it is divorced to a certain extent from our experience. And then thirdly, then, what possible relevance does this narrative have for our life today? How are we going to apply this? So those are my three questions, and we're just going to work right through the passage and with those questions in mind. The first, then, why does this give you that uncomfortable, embarrassed feel? And my answer to this question that will then need to be a little elaborated on a bit is that the discomfort that we may experience in thinking about a passage like this may say a lot more about us than it does about the text. Let's unpack that just for a little bit here. We talk about reading an ancient document like the New Testament from the lens of our own place in history, 2,000 years removed. A culture that we refer to basically as modernism or postmodernism. It's basically naturalism. It's the idea that what really exists and what we can really know about are physical objects, physical things, that all things at the end of the day are reducible to the material order. And so therefore science is the arbiter of truth and technology is the ultimate application of this. And this seems to run very much in a different direction to the ancient world reflected in a passage like this. And really, to a certain extent, in the Palestine of Jesus' day, because of its heavy Roman influence, was really filled with animism, the belief that nature is alive with spirits, that those spirits can be addressed and known in a personal way, and that you can actually have that kind of connection with spirits that lead to things like demon possession. Those two things just seem like very different worlds, and we are kind of moving through this text through the lens of our own culture to a large extent. The most influential New Testament, oddly enough, theologian of the 20th century was Rudolf Bultmann. And he wrote this, he says, in connection to passages, this passage and others like it, he says, it is impossible to use electric light and the wireless and to avail ourselves of modern medical and surgical discoveries and at the same time to believe in the New Testament world of demons and spirits. And in a certain way, that just kind of says it all, doesn't it? We've got the New Testament world where the existence of spiritual things and the influence of spiritual things is sort of taken for granted and weaves into the story. Whereas the modern person looking at the world through the lens of its scientific, naturalistic point of view just finds it impossible to believe in this New Testament world that we're reading here in the narrative of Luke. What Bultmann and his followers did then is they demythologized the New Testament. And by that, what I mean is that they basically reinterpreted passages like the one that we're studying here tonight and many others that involve the supernatural to give some other kind of explanation that would be palatable to the thinking of their contemporaries, which would namely be folks like you and me, since we're not going to identify with this Gerasene demoniac, what's that really about? Well, one of the greatest commentators, great in the sense of his popularity, wrote a piece on the Gospel of Mark that's related to this passage, as I cited earlier, and his name is Barclay. And here's what he had to say about that. He's applying Bultmann's approach. He says, Jesus, like a wise healer, like one who understood so kindly and sympathetically the psychology of a mind diseased, used the event to help the man in his climb back to sanity. It is good to know, he reflects, that the Lord can deliver us from imaginary dangers as well as from real ones. Okay, what is Barclay saying? What's he saying? That's not a rhetorical question. I'm asking you, what is he saying? There are no real demons. That's right. And so this manifestation that we're seeing, where this guy is aggressive and running around naked and things like that, these would be signs of a mentally ill person. And so really the story is not about Jesus, you know, having some sort of authority over this unseen world of the supernatural, but really is that Jesus is kind of like the master psychologist who, like, really understands. And because he, like, really understands, he's able to appeal to this guy, and he's like, I feel all better now, Doc. Good, then put on a tunic and, you know, don't stop embarrassing yourself or whatever. And that's the way that modern people really like looking at a passage like this. And I think even if on an important level you just fundamentally don't agree with Bultmann or with William Barclay or people like that, there is nonetheless that same sort of, I don't know, suspicion that you meet a passage like this with if you're like me, kind of, I pride myself, or I have at least, in really thinking reflectively about my faith and thinking in terms of, you know, what would be good rules of evidence to assess whether something that's recorded in the New Testament is actually history. And there are certain things in there that are just, you know, so far beyond my own experience that it makes the burden of proof kind of move over to the side of the biblical text. I'm a little suspicious about that. I'm just talking out loud about things that you say to your own head. I'm pretty sure that these things go on for us. But here is the question, I guess. Why must rational people accept this basic proposal, this reinventing, this retelling of the gospel stories to make them fit into the worldview of the modern world? And here I just feel like there's a huge philosophical assumption that has been driving Western society now for a couple of hundred years, this idea of naturalism that wants to say that everything is explainable through natural law and through material interactions, and that's the way it is. Outside of that analysis, you're basically dealing with blind faith, with superstition, really with the irrational. To which I ask, says who? Why must that be? Why must we accept the idea that all phenomena of experience are reducible to material interactions between things? What about things that don't seem to fit that description? Like what? How about like human consciousness? There's been no advancement in our ability to characterize human consciousness, human thought, biochemically. Yeah, we can alter the way people think by altering their brain, but thought itself really goes beyond our understanding of material interactions between things. The idea that material objects follow the prescribed and unalterable rules of nature, laws of nature, seems to be very much falsified in human experience when we make free choices. See, not caused by material things, but driven by the decision to choose one thing over another. We are aware of a whole realm of truth that we could call moral truth, for instance. Things are right or wrong, just or unjust, not because society approves some things and disapproves of others, or because we are programmed biologically to behave one way and not the other, but because we recognize inherently in certain kinds of things that they're just plain right or wrong. Which by definition takes us outside of the realm of possible material explanation. So there are a lot of people who are in that uncomfortable place where they want to hold to the objective reality of their own existence as a conscious human being, that think that things like right or wrong, good or bad are not just delusions, but are actual true descriptions of the certain kinds of behaviors and values. And it doesn't fit into this perspective. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that we have a sort of a schizophrenic culture in that way. Most of the people that we meet on the street, maybe many of you here tonight, share the kind of skepticism that I've begun this discussion with here tonight. And why? Because that's what we've been taught. And if we're a pretty educated population, most of us have gone through some sort of formal education, we've done reading, we're around thinking people, and these are the objections that are brought to us. And without kind of pushing back on those doubts, saying, oh, really, who says? And what about these counterexamples of things that you do accept that are not reducible to your basic materialistic theory? Then I think what we do is we just end up engaging the skepticism and the cynicism of our culture. We've got to be able to think this stuff through. You see what I'm saying? It's really an important thing. If we're going to really have a robust faith where our mind is connected with our heart and we're moving forward after Christ, we've got to really be convinced. We have to be able to engage those debates, those doubts, and the debates that happen within our own hearts. Well, let's move on, because I want us to understand a little bit of the backstory here. And what is going on exactly? There's a few things historically that matter. One is, as we kind of analyze this text and we think about it, against the interpretation of Barclay and others who would kind of try to find some sort of a psychological explanation for what's going on here, Luke, the author of this gospel, as we've talked about before, Luke is a physician. He himself is a man of science. He is acquainted with people who are mentally disturbed, as he records, for instance, he's also the author of Acts, in Acts 26, verse 24. He distinguishes between physical ailments and demonic activity in Luke chapter 9, verse 1, saying that Jesus came and he both healed many of their diseases and delivered many from the influence of demons. And so Luke makes it very clear that there are physical, there are psychological, and there are spiritual problems that affect people, because all those things are true of human beings. We are physical, we have minds, and we have a spirit. That's who we are. And in a broken world like the one we live in, all of those things are not the way that God designed for them to be. And Luke is very clear on each of those things. This is not the reflections of a primitive, uninformed author. Second, again in context, what we're really looking at is a picture of what we have referred to, what people refer to as paganism, animism, the idea that nature is alive with spirits who associate with objects of human desire and human need. And so all over the world, and up until fairly recent times, most places in the world, this has been the dominant view. The idea that water is not just water, but it is animated or made alive by a spiritual personality. And that's important, because the way that nature works is kind of fickle, it's unpredictable, it's dangerous. And the idea is then we got to find ways to control these forces that are beyond our ability to control. That's the religious mentality that was just pervading the ancient world. And this is an example of it, where you have somebody who is in a more personal way relating to these spiritual forces. For 1,000 years of Israel's history, they're corrupted by this very idea of falling into what is called in the Bible idolatry. It's not just that you build a statue and say, what a beautiful statue. I think I'll worship it. Idolatry really is just basically the idea that you build a physical object to represent a spiritual force that you're trying to, through incantation, through song, through ritual, through vows, through various kinds of things, you're trying to placate them so that they do what you want them to do. That is the worship of the vast majority of the world throughout time and indeed down to our present day. In that framework and in that context, individuals trade help from these spirits for the spirits' control in their life. They make deals with spirits in great poverty. We've seen this goes on. This is the majority religious attitude all over the world today. It's in Latin and South America, the Caribbean, Africa. It's all over Asia, parts of Europe. We relate to nature as a spiritual personality, and we seek favors from that spirit world. I'm sick. I have no way of dealing with my problems. And I vow that I will give you control of my life, spirit, if you come and heal me, if you give me a job, if you heal my child, if you exact revenge on my enemy, things like that. So whether it's voodoo in Haiti or Santeria in Cuba or all manner of shamanism in West Africa or in Asia, this is the way that the vast majority of people in the world relate to the world around them. This is what I want you to understand. In a certain sense, we're a bit of an anomaly here in the modern materialistic West. And so, with that in view, and just the reality of putting our own kind of suspicions about texts like this in the perspective, let's move on to our second question. Why don't we see this today? If this is really the way it is, that the Bible, what the Bible describes is in fact the case, you know, why aren't we seeing these phenomena? I don't know if that has occurred to you as a kind of a question in your mind, and we wonder, where do I go with a passage like this that seems so divorced from my own experience? Well, I want to say a couple things about this. First and most emphatically is that we do. We do. And certainly in various places in the world, again, where an animistic worldview and an engagement with spiritual personalities is more or less the religious norm, we actually see it quite a bit. I've seen it personally in India, in Haiti, and in other places as well. I want to just share with you, because we have a world reach in this fellowship. We've got stuff going on all over the world, and so we're pretty kind of connected with some of these stories, like what we read here in Luke chapter 8. And I want to introduce to you my friend Pam, who's going to come up and share with us her experiences of 20-some years in Southeast Asia dealing with exactly this population. Here's Pam.
Thank you, Jim, for asking me to come and speak to this group about some of Kurt and my experiences in Southeast Asia with the demonic realm. I guess people wonder, how is it like that? And when Jesus comes into my life, when he came into my life, he gave me light. And he says, like in Matthew 5:14, that we become the light of the world. Well, when we go to a place like Southeast Asia, where we lived for a number of years, that doesn't have any light there, there are no believers there, then those people have these issues, as Jim was saying. They need to seek revenge. They need protection. They need help financially. They want to advance in a job, or there's an enemy that's encroaching upon them. And where do they go? They have no one with light there. And so all these sorcerers crop up, and there's one on every street that will sell you any power that you want. And sometimes these powers are at great cost, including, I want this person to fall in love with me. Well, then your child will never have anyone fall in love with them. Is that okay with you? Yes. You're giving them over, sometimes at great cost. And we had a man in our neighborhood who was a witch doctor. He was our friend, and he was an older gentleman, and he told us he was really afraid of dying. And we said, why? And he said, because if I don't have a host, if I don't have an intern to put my power into when I'm dying, the demon will not let me die. I will just be in pain and in torment until there's some place for that power to go. And he did finally get an apprentice that accepted his power at the time of his death. So sometimes these people, you know, you're getting powers for different things, but sometimes it goes too far. And that happened with a friend of ours who, she was a believer, and she came to our house early in the morning, hysterical. She was exhausted. She had been up all night. Her husband had dabbled in witchcraft and had been going to the cemetery to participate in ceremonies there. And he had a list of demons that he had given his allegiance to, and now he was taken over. And she said, and he has not slept for a week, he has not eaten for a week, and the only thing he can drink is strong tea. And she said, and last night our whole community got together, and he was hurling accusations at everyone, and he was telling people secrets that no one had ever spoke of, and he was mean and hateful. And she was just weeping when she was telling me. And she said, we called the Muslim Ustad to come over to pray for him. And he did, and he spent hours, and he left a failure. The man did not change. And then we asked the witch doctor to come. And he came, and he tried to use his power to get rid of the demon, and he could not do it either. And she said, can you please come over with your husband and pray for my husband as a believer? And so we got some other believers to go, and we put on the armor of God, and we went over to his house, and we began to pray. And after about 15 minutes, I felt like I had been there for hours. It was so oppressive. And he mocked God every time we used the word, and he hurled accusations at us. And he would say things in different voices, and he says he's not going to ever leave this man. And so then finally, after hours, he kind of slumped over and he said, okay, that's it. I'm finished. It is out of me. I'm free. And he said some other things that were kind of odd afterwards. So we all went away. Heavy accusation. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen to us? People were coming in and out of this place because they had known what happened the night before. And they were sitting there for a while and then leaving. We're like, we're going to get in so much trouble with the government for doing something so overtly Christian in this Muslim community. And so, maybe the demon didn't actually come out completely, and then he's going to seek revenge on our family. And so we went home feeling very scared, and about an hour later, the lady came back over to our house, and she said, oh, the demon is gone. My husband sat down and ate this huge meal, and now he's sleeping for the first time in a week. And everyone in the neighborhood is saying, the Muslim Ustad couldn't get it out. The Dukun, the witch doctor, couldn't get it out. But it was the Christians praying that got rid of this demon. To God be the glory.
It's all yours. And I'm saying that these are things that are happening all over the world and every day. They're not head spinning around like, The Exorcist or crazy stuff like that. These are real encounters with people who have been indwelt by malevolent spirits. And as Pam has described, it's the authority of Jesus Christ, the Lord God himself, that is sovereign over these spirits, and they must yield to his authority. So these things do happen, and it's frankly just a matter of ignorance and maybe volitional ignorance that so many in the West can go on looking at passages like the one that we're describing here and say to themselves, this must be myth, this must be legend, because these things don't happen, when indeed they happen to the majority world, even if not in the West. But that does raise the question, what about our own experience? Why don't we see this today? And I would like to suggest that the West has a very different relationship to nature than the rest of the world does. And that has a dramatic and immediate effect on this whole issue of our interaction with and influenced by the spiritual realm. The reality is that biblical Christianity has set a new foundation in the West for our relationship to nature. When the good news about Jesus Christ began to spread throughout the Roman Empire, and then over time north into Europe, it came with it the idea, the understanding that there are not many spirits. There's one God, and he is sovereign over these spirits, and that he alone is the one who is worthy of our lives, our faith, our allegiance, and that he is interacting with us not on the basis of some kind of negotiation about over power, but on the basis of his mercy evidenced in Jesus Christ. Mercy, that is to say, that God took on human flesh to live among us, to die for us, so that the brokenness of our souls, our separation from God, the guilt of our conscience can be forgiven, and that we can come alive to God in Jesus Christ. And that reality then, as that message has gone out, has altered the whole landscape of what does it mean then to relate to nature. I don't need to manipulate it. I've got a God in heaven who is sovereign over it. And so in that sense, the whole focus on animism has been lost in the West. There's also, I'm a fan of biographies, and one of the most intriguing and quirky biographies I've ever read is by the British journalist G.K. Chesterton. He wrote a biography of St. Francis of Assisi, and he made this point, talking about the European Middle Ages, and the European Middle Ages were a time of, you know, world denying, and what really matters is heaven. So there was a kind of a loathing of the physical realm altogether. And he makes this point. He says, nothing could purge this obsession, and by that obsession he means animistic paganism, but a religion that was literally unearthly. It is not metaphor to say that these people needed a new heaven and a new earth, for they had really defiled their own earth and even their own heaven. And he makes this point that 1,000 years of the Middle Ages of denying the value of nature and of the world and kind of living through the veil of tears waiting for our time to go to heaven, basically from the consciousness of the Western European and later the American, just absolutely broke any kind of historical consciousness of looking to nature in through the lens of animism and seeking to manipulate it as animists do. And I think that that is really very true, and actually a pretty helpful insight in terms of a historic understanding of how we have come to view things the way we have, and therefore why we don't find in our experience and in our culture the same sort of demonism that Pam has described and which we see in this passage here today. That's why we don't see it here today in our culture. But this then brings us to our third question. What possible relevance did this narrative then have to our lives today? Oh, man. This is an important question. Let's investigate this. Let's think about this from the standpoint of our own spiritual climate today. I want to make a contrast between what we call nature and culture. Nature, as we have been describing in an animistic pagan framework, alive with spirits that we manipulate and therefore become in bondage to. Okay, that's not the experience of the supernatural that most Americans have, most Westerners have, most of you and I have. But there is another element here, which is the spiritual climate within culture itself. And this the Bible speaks to also with great forcefulness and clarity and in an important way. There's a value system in our culture, in this culture, a worldview, in other words, a set of assumptions about how the world operates and what it means to be a part of it, that in its intent and its effect blinds, distracts, and seduces people from God. And it is, its effect is every bit as powerful and its presence even more ubiquitous, more experienced, more universal than the experience of paganism in the first century Palestinian world. Just read through the letter of 1 John. It is just full of discussion along these lines. John says in 1 John 5:19, the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. Here, the world doesn't mean the physical globe. It's the word cosmos. Cosmos. Yeah, it's true. Cosmos relates to the physical universe. But the way it was used in the ancient world had more to do with the value systems of a particular culture. A sort of an outlook on life, a set of assumptions that are held. We use the word cosmos in this sense when we talk about cosmetics. It's the same word. What is a cosmetic? It's a pretty good metaphor for what we're describing here. What's the purpose of cosmetics, ladies? Let's be honest. To cover up the truth? Who said that? Let's say to enhance other features of the truth. But actually, that's pretty dead on. I mean, that's really what it's all about. Man, our culture is so about that. Cosmetics, a multi-billion dollar industry. Even men are into it now. Getting, I found this out recently. I've been hiding under a rock, apparently. Botox. You know what Botox is? It's botulism. It's a poison, for God. It literally paralyzes your face so it doesn't sag, I guess. Because sagging would be bad. Why? Because, well, we've all agreed that sagging is bad. Anyway, in the ancient world, Rome, of course, was the cosmopolis, the world city. All of the cultures of the world flooded through the Silk Road in Asia to Rome, from Africa up to Rome, from Europe down to Rome, and so forth. It was the world city, and very pluralistic, like our world is as well. And there is a kind of a collective consciousness, an outlook that becomes shared by a population, a society. It's really, in a certain way, what defines a society. Values and things that we just hold to be absolutely true, even if undefensible, we just believe that these are the case. And these are the things, and it's the grid that we look at life through. We assess our own life through the possibilities before us, defined by our worldview and our value system. And here's the deal. Our value systems are, yes, man-made, but emerge out of our spiritual condition and are animated by those spiritual personalities that are in opposition to God. And that's what he means. The whole world lies in the power of the evil one. That the values that we accept and act on in an unreflective way are not spiritually neutral. That we are, in fact, just by virtue of being a part of this culture, we are deeply influenced by spiritual personalities and ideas that are designed to move people away from God. He gets a little more specific in 1 John chapter 3, verses 15 and 16. He says, do not love the cosmos, the cosmopolitan, the makeup. Do not love the world or the things that are in the world. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but it's from the world. Now, we saw in our narrative in Luke 8 how spiritual influence absolutely directed the course of this young man's life, so that he's walking around naked with all the weirdness that goes with his life, right? I mean, everyone knew here's a guy who's controlled by these spirits, but hey, how about us? Are we also in that same situation? Just think about what he's saying here. The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride, boastful pride of life. Our culture, the lust of the flesh, the lust, that means it's an over-desire, literally in the Greek. It's over-desire. It's wanting something that's good in itself too much and having a context that is unhealthy or unethical in the expression of it. A sensual, a lust of the flesh. We worship youth. We worship beauty. We worship sex. Every bit as much as any kind of pagan cult in the Roman world. Let's be clear on that point. And that is a core value of our culture. The lust of the eyes, the things that we behold, our materialistic focus. What matters is stuff, things, tokens of success, tokens of respect, tokens of affluence. Absolutely, a material focus. What we find ourselves thinking about is buying things. We live in our whole economy. Our economy, you know what it's called? It's called a consumer economy. The whole idea is that you, to do the right thing is to spend. And before a few years ago and all the economic problems we had, it was sort of like a tacit assumption that you should be amassing as much debt as you can pay off the interest of each month. And it led to enormous bondage for so many people. The boastful pride of life, it is all about the self, how I'm viewed by others, the honor, the respect that I get from others, the desirability that I have in the eyes of others. It's all about our pride. And I think it's just pretty interesting that a couple thousand years ago, a guy like John could be looking at the world that he experienced and that he lived in and said, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, boastful pride of life. Kind of sums it up. And where we today can go, check, check, check. Because why? Because cultures may change in superficial ways, but the heart of culture never does. Because the heart of culture comes out of the broken heart of man. And that's the way we are. That we have, instead of seeing the good things that God has created as an opportunity to share in His goodness, we worship it like a god. And we worship sensual experience like a god. We worship the objects of our buying power as though they were idols, the things that we bow down to and worship them and absorb ourselves in. And why? Because really what matters at the end of the day is myself. And that is at the core of our value system. It's all about the Holy Trinity of me, myself, and I. That is our culture. That's the world's culture. That is not spiritually neutral, and it destroys lives. Let's just bring it to a conclusion here. The effects of a culture of spiritual domination is no different than the results of a person dabbling with malevolent spirits in nature. They're very similar. There's bondage, there's fear, and there's aversion. And we see these in every account in Luke 8, in Luke 5, in Mark 2, and in throughout the scriptures, the examples and what we see today as well in Southeast Asia and so many places where we have troops on the ground, that to fall into a culture that worships pride, that worships beauty, that worships sensual experience, is to become in bondage to these things. Bondage to the extent that I'll do anything to have these things. And if it's sacrificing my family so that I can just make a few more bucks and get a couple of rungs up on the ladder, you bet I'll do that. Of course. It would be un-American not to. You know, just like the old song says, what were once vices are now habits. And when we indulge our nerve endings and things without the framework of a biblical worldview and a relationship with God, these things become such a burden for us that we become addicted, that they have an ill, exaggerated place in our lives. And we live in fear of losing these things that we are looking to make our life matter. American society is a very fearful society. Are you aware? Do you think of it in those terms? It's a very fear. We're always afraid of the tentative hold that we have on the things that we do. So security, control, these are things that affect the psychological well-being of the vast majority of people in this society. Not like other places less affluent in the world. But we are a very neurotic culture. We're a very medicated culture. And we are suffering from breathing in the air of our culture that is driving lost people further out of God's orbit. There's bondage, there's fear, there's aversion. You know, you bring up in conversation, you know, this is what I'm into, I'm a Christian, and this is what it's about, that never meets with neutrality. They may say neutral things like, oh, that's nice for you, or whatever, as they're saying underneath their breath, lunatic, or, you know, whatever it is. But then, you know, the conversation turns to, have you ever thought about seeking God? And then all of a sudden, you know, that is way not neutral. Now it's a push, right? Why is that? Have you ever wondered why it is that the offer that costs you absolutely nothing, which is to receive Christ, just to say, I trust the death of Christ to be the payment for my guilt before God. I know I don't bring anything to the table. I believe that what Christ did is completely sufficient to deal with the barrier that exists between me and God. Why are people so hostile to that? It just seems like the simplest offer. Right? What do you have to lose by saying, okay, that, you know, that is interesting. I should think about that. I should study up on that. I should find out whether there's evidence behind this, or, yeah, I would like to be reconciled with God. That would be awesome. I would love to have my guilt kind of washed away and no longer an issue in my life before God. But that's not that's not how it works, does it? And there's all kind of pushback. And why is that? Because we live in a hostile spiritual climate. That's exactly why. Now, to conclude, just a couple of implications here. First, Jesus is greater than he who is in the world. All right? We don't live in fear because the power of God in Christ is greater than his adversaries. We don't live in that same sort of fear. We don't worry about being alienated from God because we have collapsed to the value system of our culture. We don't worry about being possessed or whatever. Greater is he who is in you than he is in the world. Specifically, what I think that means is that we appeal to God in prayer. We have friends, we have family, we have people that we care about who are living in bondage. Okay? Living in bondage to the value system of this culture that is sucking the life out of them and is keeping them alienated from the Lord God. And there is a spiritual opposition who's got his hands right in there. And that voice that says, yeah, keep it up, sport. Just a little bit more sport. Y'all see the movie The Devil's Advocate. Have you seen that? Al Pacino? He makes a good devil. And it's just a really, I think, a very biblical portrait of the manipulation of the evil one. Prayer that God and his Spirit would touch a person's life in a way that human words can't. And that to bring a person's name up before the throne of God, God, this person's in my life. I love them with the love that you've loved me. I care about where they are. And I know I don't have the resources to penetrate this spiritual fortress that is these ideas raised up against the knowledge of God in their heart, but you do. And I'm pleading with you, God, to reveal yourself, to break down these barriers against them. Prayer has to be absolutely the forefront of all that we do in our engaging in this lost world that we're a part of. We need to be praying. Second, we find that just as the world system is driven by the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, we find that in Christ, and when we've discovered new life in him, that those things take on a very different context. And I, again, going back to Chesterton, I really like what he says. He says, describing the biblical understanding of nature and self in the world, he says, the secret of recovering natural pleasures, because God is not an ascetic, God is not against pleasure. The secret of recovering natural pleasures lay in regarding them in the light of supernatural pleasure. That's the important thing, that I'm drawing my life from Christ. And because I'm drawing my life from him and I have a real personal relationship with God going, then I don't have to extract what I need from that other person. See, but rather I can be in a different relationship with pleasure. Pleasure becomes free to be experienced in the context that God intended it, and when it is knocked off of its perch like an idol. He says the secret of life is not the Holy Trinity, me, myself, and I. It is being the servant and the secondary figure. Oh my God. He's not saying that you don't matter. He's saying that you'll never be content being the lord of your own castle. That it's when we set aside my agenda for the purpose of God in another person's life as a secondary figure, as a servant, that is when we begin to feel closeness with others, intimacy with others. Otherwise, we're just on the take like everybody else, and everyone's got their radar up, and they see it, and that keeps us lonely and at a distance and broken and broken. And this is the way forward, is to find new life in Christ that enables us to then utterly transform in relation to our dealings with other people and our own life. And lastly, indeed, truth does matter. The one thing that the demonic world cannot do is to stand in the face of biblical truth. And Paul says in Romans 1, verse 16, he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news about Christ. Because why? Because, he says, it is the power of God for salvation. It's the word of God that is that TNT that blows away the fortresses around the hearts of lost people. It's hearing what God has to say. And then it awakens something within. And you're like, yeah, I kind of see that. I'm a little uncomfortable, but I get it. I think this might be true. And it's at that moment then that that's where we want to move toward Christ. It's the truth that opens up that door so that we can hear God knocking on the door of our heart saying, if you hear me knocking, open the door of your heart to me and I will come in and dine with you, he says. That's Revelation 3, verse 20. And so there it is. We live in a real spiritually dark world, but we have one in us who is greater than he who is in the world. I think it's really important that we confront our own tendency toward basically Christian atheism. Basically Christian atheism that says, I just do what I do and other people do what they do. There's no expectation of the supernatural and there's no sense of battle within the supernatural realm. And that is a recipe for defeat. That's why we're defeated. That's why we're not seeing change in our lives and the lives of our friends. That's why we're not able to find ourselves perhaps being as much of a catalyst in reaching neighbors with this great message that we would like to be. This is first things first, the authority of Christ over the spiritual realm. All right, so there you go. That's how I answer those three questions.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.